This is the Transcend Human Podcast, a show dedicated to the spirituality and psychology of the human condition. This year, however, we're taking a detour together as I venture into the world of writing. Each episode documents my journey from the big idea to a complete fiction novel. Join me through the highs and the lows that are sure to be part of this creative process. All right, friends, welcome back to the Transcend Human Podcast. More importantly, the Transcendent Trilogy series we're going through this year. And what is it? For those of you who haven't been around, it is basically an entire series we're doing this year on writing. Following me on this crazy journey I'm on to write a novel, part of a trilogy, book one, basically. Glad to have you with us. If you're brand new, if you've been around for a while, glad you have chosen to join me on the journey. It's been fun. Our episodes are getting less and less frequent. I think we're right around every 3 to 4 weeks now between episodes, which makes sense because life is kind of crazy. There's a lot of things going on, and there just isn't a lot as I'm kind of plodding through the writing process. It takes a while for me to come up with information for another episode. But when I find that information and I find something new, or I feel like I've kind of had a breakthrough in the writing process, that's when I really get geeked about doing another episode. And so that is kind of what has led to this episode. We'll talk more about that in a minute. So let's just do a quick review. Since last time, I'm still enduring the heat. I think we're hopefully in the death throes of summer. Hopefully we're on the last 2 or 3 days of heat. We've gone through at least a week straight of over 100 degree temperatures. The worst day being, I think, 109, 110, something like that. But the 10-day forecast, like I said, is looking pretty good as long as it holds. So we may be turning that corner toward fall or winter, whatever that looks like in California. One can only hope. The only other problem we're running into because of this heat and all of these things is fire season, which obviously is a California thing. It happens every year. But as of this morning, there are 3 very large fires basically surrounding us. So not in imminent danger of it reaching our home, but just the craziness of having them so close and basically dealing with the fallout, right? So you've got ash and you've got smoke and the air just reeks of it at times. And so that's the other thing that's going on right now. Update on Tammy. So Tammy was out of town for over 2 weeks. And that was like 2 weeks ago now. So literally right after our last episode or during our last episode, she basically drove with my oldest daughter from Los Angeles to New York City with some fun stops along the way. So my daughter wanted to have her car there while she was at law school, thus the road trip. And I don't think they would do it again. But at the same time, I think they had fun and they made some memories while doing it. So along the way, they got to see some friends and family, stay with them, things like that. And after making it to White Plains, New York, where Allie's in law school, Tammy got to spend a few weeks with, or a few days with our middle daughter, who's in Brooklyn. At that point, she flew back to San Diego. I picked her up. And yeah, just really glad that she got to do that. But at the same time, those 2 weeks were pretty rough. I mean, pretty lonely, just being here by myself. Every once in a while, Tyler would show up and would hang out for a day or so. But yeah, the only thing that broke the trip up for me was a work trip that I had to go on. So I flew with a coworker to Honolulu to meet with a client there. The workshop took most of the day that we were there, but we did have some time the day before and the day after to explore the island of Oahu. And I can definitely see the allure of not only the Hawaiian Islands, but of Honolulu and just that area. I just don't know that I could handle living there, you know, being landlocked like that. You can call it paradise, but you're also basically stuck on this little island that you can drive across in 30 minutes. So very strange. But yeah, so it was fun to see once in a while, but again, to live there or work there, I don't think I could do that. But aside from that, I think things are back to normal, if there is such a thing as normal. Like I said, Tyler is around. He's back in school. We see him half the week, basically. He's helping to coach the freshman football team at his old high school. So we've been to a few Friday night games already, and we'll probably go to a few in the future as well. The house is quiet most of the time, except for our two cats, who basically own the house and let us know that they own the house. So with that said, let us jump in. Today's topic, Harry Potter masterwork analysis and my writing progress. Chapter 1, Story Grid Resources. Chapter 2, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone Masterwork Analysis Guide. And Chapter 3, Keeping Things Moving. Chapter 1, Story Grid Resources. So by now, you're probably sick of me talking about the Story Grid. Unless that is, you're part of the Story Grid universe and use it the way that I do. But for those of you not using the Story Grid methodology, simply insert yours here. Because at the end of the day, there are literally thousands, well, maybe hundreds, I don't know, maybe tens. I don't really know. But there are a lot of different strategies to help you write your big idea. And it's kind of up to you what philosophy you want to use in order to make that happen. Even if one of those options is choosing not to use one, that's what we call pantsing. And if you're brilliant enough to do it that way, then more power to you. But for the rest of us mortals, there are story structure frameworks, things like the Story Grid, Snowflake Method, Save the Cat, three-act story structure, and the list goes on and on. In my head, it just makes sense that a good writer should pick one of these things and use it, or maybe pick a few and come up with a custom way of plotting their big idea based on those few. But at the end of the day, you have to plot your novel based on something. And for me, this was largely influenced by the Story Grid. As I've said before, Story Grid is much bigger than I can even begin to wrap my brain around, right? It's so massive. That's why I sometimes refer to it as the Story Grid universe. So I would never say that I fully understand it and that I'm a hardcore story gridder. But what I do understand, I am using, and I am trying to incorporate it into my big idea. And these are the concepts that I've basically latched onto and have kind of tried to use to mold the story before I even write it. So first off is the concept of genre. StoryGrid has this thing called the five-leaf clover genre tool. Amazing tool. I would encourage you to look it up and look through it. It's literally every possible genre and story element known to man is what it looks like. And it's really helpful in you determining, if I'm writing this story, what genre does it fall into? And then once you know what genre it's part of, that helps you with obligatory moments and conventions and things like that. So that I'm gonna put links in the story notes, or the show notes, I guess we call them. So there will be links to each of these things if you're interested. So five-leaf clover genre tool. Next is the concept of the five commandments of storytelling. This is something that I really had a hard time with when I first heard it, because ultimately the idea is that you should have the five commandments of storytelling for your book, for each quadrant of your book, for each sequence of your book, for every scene, and for every beat. Now, it blows my mind to think that it can be that detailed. But the more I've read, the more I've had masterwork analysis on other books, I've seen that ability for the five commandments to show up in all of those different things. So it's really crazy. So I've latched onto that, and I'm like, okay, I will try to make sure I have the five commandments in each of my scenes and each of my sequences and quadrants and ultimately the entire book. Next is the four quadrants. So basically the idea that you have the beginning hook, and then you have the middle build, and then the middle, I forget what it is. There's two pieces to the middle. And then you have the fourth, which is the ending payoff. So it's like breaking your story. It's still a three-act story, right? It's the beginning, the middle, and the end. But the middle is literally 50% of your book. And it's, so it's split into two. You get four quadrants. And it just helps with kind of outlining the conventions or the obligatory moments of, let's say, an action story where it's like, okay, at the end of that 25%, I'm going to have this kind of a scene. And in the very center of the book, between the two middles, there's going to be another really important scene. It just helps kind of lay out the big scenes of your book. So that's the quadrants. Next is the basics of an action story. And so I put a link there to the action genre. And if you're writing an action story, then you're going to have a bunch of things that need to be part of that story that may not be part of other stories. For example, like a horror story, or a true crime, or a romance, or, you know, whatever the story is, it's each is going to have a different set of things that needs to be in that book because it's what readers are looking for. So I linked to that, including this thing called the action story cheat sheet, which is really interesting. So if you have time to go look that up, I think it'd be helpful. So you've got the four core framework. You've got the conventions of an action story. You've got the obligatory moments of an action story. And then you've got the 20 skeletal scenes of an action story. The 20 skeletal scenes, meaning in each of those four quadrants, you have the five commandments of storytelling. So in the first 25%, the beginning hook, you're going to have five commandments. And each of those commandments could basically be one scene. So what it's saying is that in the beginning hook, you are going to have a scene that includes the inciting incident, because that's story grid commandment number one, right? And then you're going to have another scene that's the turning point progressive complication, one that's the crisis, one that's the climax, and then one that's the resolution. So what it's saying is you're going to have scenes for each of those five things in the beginning hook, the first middle build, the second middle build, and the ending payoff. That's where you get your 20 skeletal scenes for your action story. And then finally, the last thing I use is basically StoryGrid's idea of the hero's journey. They refer to it most of the time as the heroic journey 2.0. And I'm still trying to figure this out and see how it can be useful. But for those of you who have an understanding of what the hero's journey is, there's a very specific set of scenes, if you will, that make up the hero's journey, or concepts, on this journey that your hero or the protagonist goes on. So, you know, it starts out with the ordinary world, where you have a scene or at least an explanation of what their life looks like before the call to adventure. Then you have a scene that talks about the call to adventure. So what is this thing that the hero is being called to, this big journey that they need to go on? Then you have this scene called refusal of the call, where the hero is kind of like, no, I can't do that. I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. Why are you asking me? Right. And it goes on and on and on. I think there's like 11 different scenes that you would have in a typical hero's journey story. So what StoryGrid has done is they've taken their concept of writing a novel with all of their obligatory moments and conventions. And then they've overlaid that with the hero's journey to see where that kind of fits into the story as well. So super interesting. I linked to a massive infographic on that, the heroic journey 2.0, if you're interested. So there you go. Those are the basic resources that I've been using from the StoryGrid methodology. And I've also created supporting documentation like the StoryGrid spreadsheet. So there's this huge spreadsheet that the StoryGrid tells you you need to have when you're writing your novel. And it has certain rows and certain columns and all sorts of things. And as you're writing each scene, you're like filling out all of this information on the StoryGrid spreadsheet. So I took it, but I've also modified it a lot, basically to fit my needs and to incorporate certain things that I've read from sources outside of the StoryGrid, things like that. And so that's kind of what I've been doing, using that modified version of the story grid spreadsheet to kind of plot out the scenes in front of me. And then I'll go through and I'll start writing them after I've plotted them out. So this is where I was at about 3 weeks ago. I was writing, I was following my outline based on the things above. Things were going great, but then the Masterwork Guide came out, right, for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Talked about this, I think, in the last episode. I pre-ordered it. It finally arrived in the mail, and I was able to absorb it, which led to me adding one more step in my global spreadsheet, which we'll talk about in a minute. Chapter 2, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone Masterwork Analysis Guide. So like I said, I talked about this in the last episode, but I'll go over it once more so that you have the information today. StoryGrid puts out these things called Masterwork Guides, and I'll link to it in the show notes here. The idea behind them is that there are certain works that we just know are what we would call a masterwork, right? So books that have either stood the test of time, you know, were written a long time ago and we still read them today, or works that were written and they just blew up and exploded and the entire world accepted them and looks at them as amazing, that type of thing. But for whatever the reason, the thought behind it is that the reason that those blew up the way that they did, it because there was something right about them. There was something in those books that just worked. And what we are finding is that a lot of it is because they have included things like the story grid, whether they knew it or not when they were writing it. If you go back through and you analyze those books using the story grid methodology, you find that they use it almost to the letter. Like you can identify all of the different pieces in those books, which is why they are so amazing. And so what StoryGrid has done is they've taken books like Frankenstein, Hamilton, Pride and Prejudice, The Hobbit, The Tipping Point, Treasure Island, and like I said recently, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, and they've taken these books and they've created a masterwork analysis guide for each of them. I'll link to the one that I purchased, Sorcerer's Stone. Like I said, I pre-ordered it months before it was available, and then during that time, I actually read the first Harry Potter book, something that I had never done. I've watched the movies more times than I can even count, but I've never read the books until now. So I read The Sorcerer's Stone, then when the Masterwork Guide came, I read that, and I enjoyed it a lot. I mean, on some level, the book wasn't earth-shattering, right? I've seen the movie so many times that the book was almost like me watching the movie in my head. But it was really cool to experience it straight from the pen of J.K. Rowling, the way that she had kind of envisioned it, right, and the way she wrote it. And the Masterwork Analysis provided this unique insight into how the Sorcerer's Stone fit into the action story genre, how Rowling incorporated the conventions, the way that she integrated the obligatory moments, the 20 skeletal scenes from the book. Then the guide basically walks through every single scene using an analysis tool that I hadn't really heard of before. And this was really my takeaway from the book and the thing that I've now since incorporated into my future plotting of my scenes. I'll just call it the scene analysis for short. But for each scene, the writers of the guide, which is Savannah Gilbo and Abigail K. Perry, they analyzed the scene in the following way. First, they ran the scene through four Socratic questions. And these questions are meant to determine if there is a story event. This is a very important concept, a story event. And according to the story grid methodology, each scene has to have a story event that works. Otherwise, it's not a functioning scene, right? Every scene has to include at least one story event. So back to the four questions that help you determine if there is a story event. Question one is, what are the characters literally doing? What are their micro on the surface actions? This is called OTS, or on the surface stuff. And really what this question is getting at is, what is the plot point from the scene, right? What's the external plot point, the thing that's going on? Question number two, what is the essential tactic of the characters or the protagonist or the, or a character in the scene. That is, what is above the surface, macro behaviors that they are employing that are linked to a universal human value. This is called ATS, which is above the surface. And this question really gets at the internal story arc, right? The motivations and the inner desires of the character or characters. Question three is what beyond the surface universal human values have changed for one or more of the characters in the scene, and which is the most important. This is called BTS, or beyond the surface. And this question is really from the writer's point of view, right? It's so you're basically writing down what the scene is trying to do overall. What is the most important value shift in the scene? For example, did a character go from ignorance to knowledge or from happiness to dread? Things like that. And then question four is, what story event sums up the three previous questions? So the answer, this answer is written as a succinct story scene event summary. So a scene story event summary. And this is kind of what I would throw in my global spreadsheet for that scene as kind of the description of that scene. And it really includes a summary of the three elements above. So OTS on the surface plus ATS above the surface and BTS or beyond the surface. So you take those three things that you came up with and you write them into one short summary sentence. Now I know it starts to get confusing, and it did to me as well. Especially I had to go back and reread the descriptions of each of those four questions numerous times before I finally caught on. It's like learning algebra for the first time, right? Or an entirely new language. It just doesn't make sense. But after reading the Masterwork Analysis Guide and working through these four questions for every single scene, it over time started to make sense. And I've since made this part of my pre-writing work for each scene, but more on that later. The next thing the writers do is they walk through the five commandments of storytelling for every single scene. So this is super helpful again, because the five commandments are almost as difficult to understand at times as the story event, right? The questions we just walked through. But after you see them pulled out of every single scene in the book, you start to get into the rhythm. And before long, you're thinking about your scenes using that language. And then the final piece that the writers included for each scene was a list of notes. So these notes, it was just a bullet list of different things that they had thought of as they were analyzing the scene. So further explanations, reasons why they identified things the way that they did. At times, the reader may not agree that a scene includes everything that the writers included in the scene, but that's okay. The way they describe it is that much of this analysis work is subjective. So the writers basically included their notes to help the reader understand why they chose the scene decisions the way that they did, right? Because when you read when you read The Sorcerer's Stone, or I think any of the Rowling books, there are huge chapters, and these chapters aren't scenes. So just because it says chapter one, The Boy Who Lived, or whatever the title is for chapter one, that doesn't mean that that is scene number one. There could be two scenes in that chapter, there could be three scenes, or scene one could literally be all of chapter two and into chapter, or chapter one and into chapter two, right? So they were having to basically take chunks of the book and pull them out and say, this is scene number one, and this is scene number two, and things like that. So like I said, they added notes, you know, to help explain why they chose the scenes that they did. Other people might choose differently. But that's the power of, and the fun of being able to analyze a book, is seeing it from your perspective. So if you're a story grid or a story structure geek like me, I think you would find these books fascinating. I would encourage you to pick one up. Like if you were a huge fan of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, I would grab that one, just because you'll probably already know the book so well that the analysis guide will be super helpful. Chapter three, keeping things moving. So I don't have a lot today for this chapter, but I wanted to highlight a few things that I've made progress on. First is adding story event elements to my global spreadsheet. And second is reworking some scenes for continuity. So first, adding story event elements to my global spreadsheet. So like I said before, this came directly from the Masterwork Analysis Guide that I read for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. And I took the concept of story event and the four questions that come along with it. And my thought was this: if this is the way an editor breaks down a story that is already published or a manuscript that is already written and sent to them, and they're looking to make sure that it has these four things in each scene, then why couldn't you do the opposite? Why couldn't a writer simply come up with the four things first and write their scenes around those four things? So in my global spreadsheet, I added four rows above the five that I already had for the five commandments of storytelling. And in truth, there's actually more than those, but let me run through them so that I can share my thought process on that. So in my global spreadsheet, there is a chunk of rows. And in that chunk, row number one is the OTS element of the scene. So this is the plot point, right? This is just me riffing on, here's what's going to happen physically in this scene. Row number two is the ATS, the above the surface element. So this is the internal story arc. This is where I would document like the tactics and the motivations and the internal changes that I expect to be happening in the character or characters in the scene. Row number three is the BTS element of the scene. So this is the beyond the surface. This is my perspective as the writer. What am I trying to accomplish in this scene? What am I moving forward? What are my goals? How does this actually impact the entire story down the road? And what value shift takes place because of it? Row number four is that summary, right? A full summarized description of the scene using row one, row two, and row three and combining them. So by doing that, now I have my actual description for the scene. In row five, I have a thing called value shift. And this is where I, typically you can just document this in row three above, but I broke it out because I just wanted it to be easier to see. So this is the important value shift in your scene. And it can just be, you know, two or three words. It can say ignorance to knowledge, or knowledge to ignorance, or contentment to incontentment, non-contentment, or fear or anxiety. You're basically shifting this human value in the scene so that a protagonist or a character goes from feeling one way to feeling another. And it's usually on the opposite sides of the spectrum, right? That's what makes a scene change, or they call it turning of the scene, which then is something that the reader really gets invested in, right? Because it's like, oh no, something happened, and now my character is doing this instead of that, or feeling this way instead of that way. And it just adds that chaos to the story that keeps people interested. So that is row five. Row six is polarity. So this is something that came out of StoryGrid as well. And basically polarity is negative to positive or positive to negative. Now you can have negative to negative or positive to positive, but it's not encouraged, because a scene works best when, just like the value is shifting, the polarity is shifting as well. So going from a negative to a positive, or a positive to a negative, they kind of go hand in hand. But I have two rows there to show those things. Row seven is where I start my five commandments. So I have the inciting incident. Row eight is the turning point, progressive complication. Row nine is the crisis. Row 10 is the climax. And then row 11 is the resolution. Now, like I said, those aren't the only rows in my global spreadsheet. In fact, I think I'm up to over or close to 30 rows right now. Some are header rows, but most of the rows are other important information like the scene number, the scene focus, word count, obligatory moments, observed elements from the hero's journey, backstory elements, red herrings, foreshadowing, callbacks, all of those kinds of things where you can also, after you've written a scene, go back and fill these things in later. That way you can always go back to your global spreadsheet and kind of see a high level overview of your entire scene and your entire quadrant and your entire story without having to just read through scenes to find the information. So those are things, like I said, that you can add after the fact, but the more important ones to me are the ones that you're adding before you ever write the scene, right? And these are the new ones that we talked about related to story event. These are the ones that I hope to fill in first before I ever even start writing the scene. I'm looking at these as plotting devices, even though that's not what they were designed for. So my thought was this: if I can come up with an idea for a scene, then plot out these three things in the spreadsheet, right? The OTS, the ATS, and the BTS. So the basic plot and action of the scene, the character or characters' internal changes and goals and desires, and then my reason for the scene and how it moves the story forward. From there, I should have a pretty good idea where to go with the scene. I mean, I'm still going to write it how I want to write it, coming up with ideas and beats and action and dialogue as I go, but it will ensure that I have at least those three elements above firmly planted somewhere in that scene, and that should keep me on track. And I want to incorporate this into a more forward-thinking approach to my plotting. The way that I described it above sounds like I'm going scene by scene, coming up with the idea, documenting the three things, and then writing the scene. But what if I did a whole chunk of those scenes at one time? At this time, I'm currently finishing up the beginning hook of book number one, the first 25%, the first 20 scenes. And I basically have descriptions written for each scene in this section. But after that, I have nothing, nothing but the big idea. So my hope is to sit down at some point in the near future and do a brainstorming session where I do the following, where I plot out the next 20 scenes. So the scenes for the first half of the middle build. Then come up with a general idea for each of those scenes, flesh out the OTS, ATS, and BTS for each scene, and then summarize them into the official description for that scene. Then, from there, I should be able to enter a writing session knowing exactly what comes next. I'm either continuing work where I left off from a previous scene, or I'm starting a new scene with all of the initial information right there in front of me. So that's my latest addition to the writing process. I'll let you know how it goes in the coming months. But before we leave this topic, I thought I would leave you with an example from the Sorcerer's Stone Masterwork Analysis Guide. So I chose scene 9, which comes out of chapter 7, The Sorting Hat. So the writers of the guide said that the OTS, the on-the-surface activity, is Harry and the other first-year students entering the castle to get sorted into their houses. The physical change of locations is students going from outside to inside and moving from first year into specific houses. So that's the on-the-surface information that you get in scene 9. Above the surface, Harry wants to get settled in and wants to belong. He panics when the Sorting Hat might put him in Slytherin and tells the hat no, not to place him there. The hat listens and places him in Gryffindor. And the change in the internal arc, Harry goes from nervous to relieved. So you can see right there, the OTS was very plot driven, right? It's just we're people moving from X to Z, people doing certain things. The next one, the above the surface, is more of the internal story arc, right? It's how Harry's feeling based on his goals and his beliefs about life. And then the next one is the BTS, or the beyond the surface. So this is the what the author is hoping to get across in the scene. It says, although safe at Hogwarts and placed in a good house, Harry is now one step closer to Professor Quirrell, the Sorcerer's Stone, and ultimately Voldemort. However, getting into Gryffindor will help Harry learn, practice, and be ready for whatever comes. And the change in the scene is in Harry, and the change is from potential for danger to potential for growth. And then the scene synthesis, so when the writers basically took all three of those and summarized it into one sentence, this is what they came up with. Harry is sorted into Gryffindor after pleading with the Sorting Hat to not put him in Slytherin. And there you go. Pretty simple and to the point, right? because it captures the three things above and summarizes the most important elements of the scene. It doesn't need to include the fact that the first years arrived at Hogwarts. It doesn't need to include the fact that after being sorted into their homes, the prefects walked them to their houses, because the most important story event was the interaction with the Sorting Hat. So there you go. Hopefully that was helpful, helped explain the way story event questions work and how they could be incorporated into the prep work for a scene, doing it before you even write the scene. Now, second, so the first thing that we talked about was this story event thing, me adding this into my global spreadsheet. That's one of the things that I've done since our last episode. The second is really just doing some cleanup on my work in progress since our last episode. Now, I know I said I wasn't going to do this. My desire from this point on was to literally just finish the first draft, just crank through it and get it done, knowing that there will be numerous revisions at that point, which will fix a lot of the story issues that I've created. But the issues I found were pretty bad. I mean, they were glaring, and it felt like something that had to be fixed before I could move on. So how did I find them? Great question. I found these problems because I read a bunch of the story out loud to my wife. That's it. I had never really showed her anything to this point, and for some reason, it just felt like a good idea. It felt like good timing. We had some conversations about it, and I'm like, hey, what if I just read you some sections of the first nine scenes I wrote, and you just give me like honest feedback on that? Now, I know she's not the demographic for my book, right? She doesn't like sci-fi or fantasy. She enjoys the action genre, but it's not her go-to. And stories that have to do with the end of the world really aren't at the top of her list either. So at some point I thought, you know, well, it'll be good. I should at least have her hear some of it and see what she says, right? And I was thinking more in terms of like the beginning hook, the inciting incident. Is it something that actually hooked you, right? Is the story clear? Do you understand what's going on? Is it interesting or is it too technical? Would you keep reading based on the fact that you just read something that is intriguing, or would you put it down? Now, I don't really know what I was expecting. I guess I probably assumed the worst, right? That she'd be like, nah, yeah, just not a big fan, not really into it. But I was pleasantly surprised. She totally admitted that it wasn't her typical story, not something that she would probably pick up at a bookstore, but she did find it interesting. And she said that she would probably keep reading because the story created intrigue and little breadcrumbs along the way that she wanted answers to. So to me, that was the motivation I needed, right? I know it, she's my wife, she has to be nice, right? On some level, yes. But at the same time, I told her to be brutally honest. Like, I'm not going to be butthurt if you don't like the book right now. Why would I get angry over constructive criticism? If it's something that I know will make the book better and help it be more successful, why would I be frustrated with that? So on some level, I trust her, right? That she was being honest and that her constructive criticism came from a place of honest reflection. And that if I took that feedback seriously, then it could only make the story better. That said, while I was reading the scenes out loud, I noticed problems, which is probably why so many of the videos I've watched on writing say that it's a good thing to read your book out loud to yourself, or even read dialogue into the mirror, right? Because it helps you catch things that just don't sound right, or things that sound cliche or cheesy or whatever. So as I was reading the scenes, I realized that there were some continuity problems. According to videomaker.com, in an article titled Five Types of Continuity, there are, you guessed it, five buckets of continuity that we can keep our eye on when we're writing. There's continuity of information, continuity of action, continuity of look, continuity of movement, and conventional continuity. Now, this article was written for screenwriters, so some of it is very specific to the fact that you're seeing things on screen, right? And this is very different than the way a writer would write a book and trying to describe something. But I thought it was a good introduction to the concept of continuity. For writing, I would actually add a couple more. I would add continuity of time, which is basically ensuring that your dates and times and time spans are logical, and that it's easy for the reader to string events together and understand the progression of time. Then there's continuity of place or location. So really ensuring that your locations feel the same from scene to scene. For example, if J.K. Rowling described Diagon Alley one way when she first introduced it, and then a totally different way in later scenes, it would be very confusing. If she explained that you had to go through the leaky cauldron in order to get from the Muggle world into the Wizarding world, but then later suggested in the book that there was a different way to get in, that would be very confusing. Unless, of course, it was on purpose and the new way to get in was a secret way or something like that. But you have to be very good at explaining that in order to keep the reader from being confused. And then the last one that I would add, though there could be many more, is character or group continuity. So for me, this is something that I feel like is going to be particularly important because I have multiple protagonists and each is surrounded by a group of characters specific to them. And in order to maintain continuity, I need to think through what each protagonist is doing and what the other characters are doing at the same time, or what one protagonist is doing on one side of the world or the globe and what the other protagonist is doing on the other side of the world at the same time. I also need to think through the groups of characters, right? So what is each character in the group doing while the others are in focus? And then there's the character continuity that exists for each and every single character, ensuring that they act in a certain way, they talk in a certain way throughout the entire book. So for example, if somebody stutters, they need to stutter throughout the entire book, right? Not just the first time you are introduced to them, and then magically the dialogue is just back to normal for the rest of the book. So when I read the scenes out loud to my wife, I noticed that there were continuity issues that fell mostly into the information and place or location buckets. So the first thing, I'll just kind of give you some information about the story. So first off, there's an artifact or a device that is found in the prologue of the book. In the prologue, I describe it one way. Then in subsequent scenes, I describe it in another way. And after writing those subsequent scenes, I realized that none of them were correct. The device really needed to look like this rather than that. So I went back to each of the places where I described the device and I ensured that they were all consistent. Second, I had written an entire scene using the Great Pyramid of Giza as the location and the structure in which the scene took place. The funny thing is this, I've never been to or even seen inside the Great Pyramid of Giza. So my scene made a lot of assumptions, most of which were incorrect. And after reading it to my wife, I was like, I don't really know that this could happen inside of the pyramid. So I went and I found a video called A Full Walkthrough of the Pyramid of Giza. And after I watched that video, after seeing that, I completely understood the problem. Instead of having the entire scene take place in the pyramid, I had to create a fictional visitor center, a building that had a lot more space where most of the action could take place before the team ever got into the pyramid. Now, you can say this had nothing to do with continuity, that it was just a dumb writing mistake based on a lack of knowledge, or me choosing not to do the research I needed to do in order to understand that location. And that would be somewhat true. But since I had already created the location in the prologue and then realized the problem in subsequent scenes, to me, it became a continuity thing, regardless of whether it was correct in terms of reality or not. So I rewrote the recent scenes, but then also went back to the prologue to ensure that it set up the new ideas correctly. So there you go. Again, going back and editing was something I said I didn't want to do. I wanted to stay away from it. But since it was a glaring thing, I really wanted to take care of it immediately. Now, I feel pretty confident that all 8 scenes are working well together, and it's safe to move on. I know there will be future drafts where, with the help of an editor, I can address continuity issues again, but for now, at least a couple of those glaring issues were addressed. So let's land the plane. First off, thanks for hopping on again today and spending some time with me on my writing journey. I hope you have something that you're working on as well. And I hope that these conversations are helpful, even if you would consider yourself something other than a writer. Believe it or not, I think some of this stuff can be applied to screenwriting, music, poetry, and possibly even art. Might be a stretch, but it's possible. Whatever it is, I'm just glad that you're here, And I wish you all the best on your work in progress, your big idea. And with that, friends, I am out. So have a great week. And as always, keep transcending human.